Let's have the discussion. You're listening to Canter with Scott and Adam.
Hello and welcome to Canter. I'm Scott Hillier.
And I'm Adam Breeze.
And in this episode, we sit down with Emily Rigby of Cannatrek. Emily discusses trials and tribulations of building and operating a cannabis facility in Australia. Emily also chats about commercial cultivation and common issues and stigmas associated with cannabis.
Enjoy the chat and remember to follow us on Instagram at Canter Podcast. Let's get into it.
We've got on the line a very special guest from the east coast of Australia, Emily Rigby of Cannatrek. How are you doing, Emily? Welcome to the show.
I'm well. Thanks so much for having me.
It's great to have you here. Emily, your resume is quite full. You've got a lot of titles. You've got a lot of programs that you're a part of. Can you just give us a run through of your background and how you found yourself in the cannabis space?
Yeah, sure. So I'm a horticultural research scientist, and I originally started working in ornamental horticulture after I finished my Bachelor of Science at the University of the Sunshine Coast. I was also teaching scientific research methods at the university as well. And I was working in ornamental horticulture for about 10 years. And after about 7 or 8 years, I started to realize that the ornamental horticulture industry had been really good to me in developing my career and as a research scientist. I realized it wasn't what the field I'd chosen. And while working in ornamental horticulture, which is all the pretty plants, all the things you can't eat, so cut flowers and foliage and nursery plants, while that had been really good for me, and I'm not saying that ornamental horticulture doesn't have its place in society, you know, to make people feel better, I was looking for something that was a lot more worthwhile for humankind. And I was lucky enough to be embarking on a Nuffield scholarship in 2016 to look at protected cropping, so greenhouse growing in subtropical climates, as well as looking for any new or underutilized crop species. And just as I was leaving on that scholarship, they changed the legislation allowing for medicinal cannabis in Australia. And I knew that was the opportunity that I'd been waiting for. That was the new crop that I wanted to grow. So I was very lucky to get my foot in the door of a couple of cannabis facilities in the US and Canada and Israel during those travels. And when I came back, I, you know, quickly became an expert in cannabis in Australia because it was so new, and started consulting in 2016. And by 2017, I moved full time over into medical cannabis. And it's been an amazing journey since then.
That's an awesome story. You mentioned the subtropical climates. The listeners might be able to hear the birds in the background. You have an amazing garden behind you. Unfortunately, the listeners can't see that, but it must be a really cool location that you're in to have this fascination in horticulture.
Yeah, look, I think you have to be surrounded by nature, and it's definitely helps with a busy lifestyle to get that work-life balance.
Yeah, good way to extract yourself from the hectic day-to-day goings, I guess. Now, Cannatrek, were you involved with the founding of this company, or how did you get on board with those guys?
Yeah, so I started working with Cannatrek in 2017. I was their second official employee, so definitely been involved with Cannatrek since startup. So worked initially on our license and permit applications, which if any of your listeners have had the honour of going through the process of applying for permits and licences with the Office of Drug Control, they would appreciate that. Definitely takes longer than you think, and they do want a lot of detail. There's a lot of red tape and regulatory burden to get through. So I've definitely worn many hats at Cannatrek from startup, from applying for licenses, facility design, security in particular was something I definitely became an expert on when at the time I don't even think I locked my front door. So it was quite interesting designing the security for a cannabis facility in Australia. Yeah, really learning the regulations, so being able to understand, all the different regulations in the cannabis industry. Then some of the more exciting things like selecting our genetics, designing the greenhouse facilities, I've then, you know, since we started growing, was leading the cultivation program. But as this year, our team's just expanded massively, which is really great. So I've been able to sort of wear less hats this year towards the end of the year and really pass off some of those roles to some of our new staff. And we've really built such a fantastic team at Cannatrek. And, you know, just really proud of all of our achievements.
It must be really cool to get on so early with a company because, as you mentioned, you got to wear all of these hats and now you get to focus on mm-hmm. certain avenues. But it's a fairly unique opportunity for people to get such access to what goes on, what makes a cannabis company tick.
Yeah, and I think that goes with any industry or any business. If you're involved with startup, you've really got to have multiple different skills and be able to jump between. When I first wanted to move into cannabis, as a research scientist, I was just so excited to look at, you know, optimizing cultivation and propagation methods, look at plant breeding and developing, you know, new strains or cultivars and new product formulations and personalized medicine. And then I realized, you know, that there were so many setbacks and so much regulatory burden that, you know, in order for me to get to the research side, I was really going to have to take on, you know, more of an advocacy role to assist the industry to actually get off the ground, because we should be a lot further along than we are. Like even for Cannatrek ourselves, we thought we'd be growing a lot earlier than we were able to start growing. Due to the Office of Drug Control just being severely under-resourced, and even patient access. There's just so many areas, you know, being a new industry, there's so many areas that need, you know, more education, advocacy, lobbying governments, educating doctors, patients. There's just so many areas that, you know, that we need to create from scratch and really work with the government, work with our doctors and patients, you know, to make this industry a success and a you know, freely available, affordable medicine.
There seem to be more and more advocates and lobbyists popping up across Australia. It's great to see. Some of the issues with the regulators, the Office of Drug Control primarily, what are we looking at, 12 to 18 months for a license to be approved?
Yeah, probably a minimum. Like I attended a conference a week or so ago that John Skerritt presented at, and I think he said it was something like 2 years on average until you receive your permit. So we do currently have 52 license holders in Australia licensed to cultivate medical cannabis, but we've actually only got 13 of those companies receiving a permit to actually start growing, and for those 13 companies, such as Cannatrek, you know, we're relieved and it's fantastic to actually start growing, but we need more growers in Australia, because we need more medicine being produced in Australia so that we're not relying on imports, and so we can bring the cost to the patient down. And we've got such fantastic growing conditions here in Australia. We really shouldn't be relying on imports.
So with the import side of things, did Cannatrek get involved with imports to get some cash flow happening when the company started up?
Yeah, look, I do think it is really important that the imports have been available. Obviously, with a brand new industry, it was really important that patients could get access to medicines as quickly as possible. And so importing medicines into Australia was definitely critical in order to be able to do that. And Cannatrek, in order to support the patients in Australia, does import medicines as well. And that's assisted with cash flow, because none of us expected to be held up so long with the Office of Drug Control, you know, in that pre-revenue phase, while you've had so many outlays, you know, paying staff, but also actually building your facility and, you know, basically building Fort Knox for a plant, which seems a little bit ridiculous. But, you know, we're abiding by the regulations, but also working with the ODC to try and remove some of the unnecessary regulatory burden. But I think we really need to speed up that process so that we can have more people growing in Australia, and then we can supply Australian patients, but we can also export to the rest of the world as well.
Yeah, you mentioned our climate, and this, it would be a real shame if Australia didn't become a major exporter of this plant. Yeah, we've got everything at our doorstep. So, yeah, why not open it up and allow that to happen? The other issue that I assume you would have encountered was building a market. I mean, what is it, 4 years ago there was no market. There were no registered patients or anything like that. So how hard has it been to build up that demand?
Yeah, look, I think the demand is there. It's educating doctors and patients on how to access it. We've got a huge black market or green market, if you want to call it, in Australia, and it's going to take a long time to bring those patients across to the legal market. So being a black market, it's really difficult to quote on the statistics, but, you know, we do believe that there is a huge black market in Australia, and we do need to make sure that we're providing high quality and affordable medicines in a manner that's easy for patients to access so that they can easily go to their own doctor, or if their doctor is not sure how to do it, they can access another doctor that's not too expensive, and then, you know, get those approvals. And if you have a look at the SASB approvals, and they release the figures monthly, you know, we're constantly increasing, you know, exponentially the number of patients that are accessing medical cannabis. Doctors are getting educated. Often the patients are more educated than the doctors, although we're starting to see that change a little bit now. But we need to remember, you know, our medical professionals haven't been taught about medical cannabis or the endocannabinoid system. We've only actually recently discovered the endocannabinoid system in the 90s. So if you could imagine only just discovering the immune system or the nervous system a few decades ago, it's actually a pretty incredible discovery. But in saying that, we're still not teaching about the endocannabinoid system in medical schools. So, you know, our doctors that have, you know, been at university for 10 years or more, they haven't been taught about it. And we need, you know, to improve the education for doctors that are at university, but also for our doctors, you know, that are already practicing. And there's some fantastic groups around Australia that are putting together education programs so that our doctors can quickly and easily learn about medical cannabis and how to prescribe it. And then what we're seeing now is the price of accessing cannabis specialists is coming down, all because of competition. You know, if there's only a handful of doctors you can go to, they can charge whatever they want. Same with your medicines. But as soon as you've got hundreds, if not thousands, of doctors online and thousands of different medicines you can choose from, it's competition that brings the price down.
Yeah, it's great to hear that there's an increasing number of people embracing it and wanting to educate about it. I think even one of our, in terms of myself and Adam, one of our family members has recently completed university doing a medicine degree, and they have been taught that cannabis isn't medicine as recently as 2 or 3 years ago. So that's quite frustrating for us to hear. And it just shows that the institutions are still, I guess, resistant to embracing this at some levels.
Yeah, and you've really got to remember that, you know, cannabis has been, you know, subjected to misinformation for almost 100 years. And it's not overnight that we can remove the stigma that decades and decades of misinformation has put in place. But, you know, when I first started working in the cannabis industry, I was reluctant to tell people that that's what I did. I was even reluctant to move into the cannabis industry. And there's a particular cannabis facility in Florida that I actually, you know, I actually need to thank for convincing me, you know, to not worry about the stigma attached to the cannabis plant, because I wasn't sure how I was going to tell people what I was doing. Would that limit countries that I could travel to in the future because of that stigma? And at first I'd be hesitant to tell people what I did, because some people would hold very strong views against cannabis, even as a medicine. Whereas now I tell everybody, you know, if I jump in an Uber and they say, what do you do? I have no problem telling them. And usually by the end of the trip, you know, you've handed over a business card or written down a few websites for them, because there's always someone wants to know, how do I get involved? Either for themselves or for a loved one. There's so many people that, you know, that want to try it, that have heard that it could be beneficial for, you know, for their medical indication.
Yeah, I think it's very important for people such as yourself to talk about it. And I do understand the fears that you may be held prior to opening up. Even since we started doing this podcast, it just opens so much dialogue with the people around us. And I think that dialogue is essential in removing that stigma. So the more of us out in that community that do discuss the plan and its benefits, the better off we'll be in the long term. So, yeah, hats off to you for being one of the first people in Australia to publicly go out there and put your name on it. Let's get into
definitely
Sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, yeah, the more we talk about it, the better. You know, your friends, your family, your neighbours, your politicians, your business colleagues. Yeah, the more we talk about it, the better.
Yeah, and it's fascinating how many people around me personally that I've noticed I maybe misinterpreted the way they would have taken the discussion, and how many people are open to learning about it and sort of embracing it. So, like you say, how many people are silently sort of pro-cannabis in some form?
Yeah, I think there's a huge number of people, and there's a lot of people that are interested in, you know, in getting access to it, whether it's for themselves or for a loved one. And a lot of people are, you know, a bit unsure about how to do that. And maybe their GP is not educated enough or open to the idea. But if they're not, there's so many fantastic doctors in Australia that have really been pioneers in the industry to, you know, to take that initiative to educate themselves and become specialists. And it's, you know, so if you're looking for someone, who understands and your GP can, you know, provide you a referral to them, then definitely, you know, whether it's Cannatrek that can assist you to find a doctor in your region or one of the other cannabis specialists or clinics, then you just really need to reach out or jump on our website and have a look at Cannatrek Access, and we can help you find someone if your doctor's, you know, not willing or not aware enough of the process, because unfortunately it's not as simple as them just writing you a script like they would for any other pharmaceutical. It is a little bit more of a complex process.
Yeah, when you say it's a little bit more complex, I think we should point out that it's still not terribly difficult for them either. I think whilst they have to do more, I think every GP can actively prescribe. Here in WA anyway, there is more paperwork involved, but you can do it.
Yeah, definitely. Every GP can. They just need to go through that special access scheme and just has a little bit more paperwork. But once they've done it once, it's really simple.
Yeah, that's really good. And I like that you call the GPs that have been prescribing up till now pioneers, because they genuinely are. Early on with legalisation of medicinal cannabis in Australia, there was reluctance and hesitation from the Royal Australian College of GPs. They were hesitant to embrace it as a medicine, and I guess it took real courage for a lot of those GPs to perhaps go not against but contrary to what was being put out there by the RAC GP.
Yeah, and I think you'd find a lot of those doctors have been touched somehow by cannabis, through their, either through loved ones or something like that. Like there's almost everyone you talk to, you know, especially before cannabis was available legally as a medicine, there was a lot of people who used it as a last resort, whether it was, you know, for themselves or for a loved one. And so people started to realize that, you know, there has actually been a lot of misinformation, and there is a lot of good research out there, and there are other countries around the world, you know, that have legalized medical cannabis earlier than Australia. And so we've been able to look, you know, to some of the states in the US and Canada and Israel, and actually start, you know, and look at where they've been using it medically earlier than we were here in Australia. But then to think back that this was a medicine before prohibition, this was a medicine for thousands of years. So it's actually quite interesting to look back into the history you know, even Queen Elizabeth, you know, being prescribed medical cannabis. So it's definitely nothing new. Like, it's just where we're just having to remove all this stigma, get rid of the misinformation, and now play catch up on, you know, 70 odd years of missed research into, you know, really fine tuning the, you know, the cannabis plant itself and the cultivation methods, but then also, you know, the product formulations and matching those to patients.
Yeah, that's cool. Let's get onto those cultivation methods. And you guys have a 3,200 square meter facility up there in Queensland. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're doing up there with your cultivation side of things?
Yeah, sure. So we've been growing for just over a year now. We're at full capacity and we work on a perpetual harvest. So we initially brought in our genetics from seed because that is one of the easier ways to bring genetics into Australia. Unfortunately, we don't have access to any illegal genetics, which is a shame because other countries have had amnesties to bring in those genetics. So we've brought in 20 different genetic cultivars or chemovars. Some of your listeners would refer to them as strains. We've now narrowed that down to about 6 to 8 that we're really interested in, but I've also got my eye on some other genetics that I'm going to be bringing into Australia early next year as well. So we're always searching for better chemovars to bring in. We're not working on plant breeding just at the moment because we're just fine-tuning the genetics that we've got. So we're looking at we've got a diverse array of high THC varieties. We've then got varieties that are high in CBD with little to no THC. And then we've got balanced varieties as well, where we've got sort of equal THC and CBD, or it might be more like a 2-to-1 ratio, which we're really interested in. So what we're looking at, obviously we're looking for yield and cannabinoid content, but we're also looking at growth vigor, pest and disease resistance, a variety of different variables that we're assessing so that we can provide, you know, again, look, you know, look, always keeping that patient in mind. So Cannatrek definitely has a very patient-centric focus. So we're making sure that we're matching our cultivation strategy and the genetics that we're growing for our medicines, whether that's as a whole flower or we're also going to be releasing milled flower products as well, which some patients have, you know, indicated that they're interested in. And then, of course, we're also sending some of our biomass for extraction to create different tincture formulations as well. So we have a lot of R&D at our facility. So we're looking at, you know, varying different plant stages, looking at different media, perfecting our nutrient recipes, plant density, so the number of plants that you put on a bench, how spaced out they are, how long we leave them in veg before we put them into flowering. Sort of, you know, a whole variety of different agronomic research. The regulations do require all cannabis to be tested for chemical residues, so pesticide residues. Obviously, if you get if you do get prescribed cannabis for vaporization, you know, we're also not sure when you vaporize or actually combust the cannabis, a pesticide that may be suitable for ingestion, you know, the chemical properties of that chemical could be completely different when it's combusted or vaporized. So we don't know the safety. So even if it might be perfectly fine to put this pesticide on a cucumber, for example, and you can eat that either straight away or within, you know, it has a withholding period, that's, you know, that's for ingestion. And so we just don't know when it comes to cannabis, when it comes to vaporizing or even smoking the cannabis flower. But also for me personally, it's the way I prefer to grow. So even before coming into the medical cannabis industry, I was always, you know, looking at more biological farming methods and really holistic cultivation strategies where you're, you know, where you've got an integrated pest management program and you're really, you know, reaching for chemicals as the last resort. Whereas in cannabis, it's almost even better. You really can't reach for those chemicals even as a last resort. So it's better for the patient, it's better for the plant, it's better for my staff, it's better for the environment. It does mean you have to be a lot more proactive effective in your cultivation strategy, though, because if you do have an outbreak, you can't reach for one of those hard chemicals to clean it up.
We haven't covered really in this podcast in our first 20 episodes the concept of beneficials, and I think now's the perfect time to get someone such as yourself to educate our listeners a little bit on beneficials and what sorts of methods you do have to use when you are pesticide free.
Yeah, sure. So it's been really exciting actually being able to work with beneficial insects and other biological control agents. So when we're looking at using beneficials, it's definitely more of a preventative as opposed to a curative approach. So we weekly release beneficial insects throughout all of our four greenhouses. And so this can be anything from predatory mites to lacewings to beneficial nematodes. We also use beneficial bacteria and fungi. So, beneficial insects are probably some of our hardest workers in the greenhouse. They'll actively seek out their food source. So if it's aphids that they're after, they're really good at finding those aphids. So we have parasitoid wasps as well. So we actually employ a diverse array of different beneficial insects, and then we've got soil drench or media drench applications as well to look at applying beneficial fungi or bacteria or beneficial nematodes actually into the growing media. And so it's really we have a lot of plant monitoring. So nothing ever replaces having your growers in the greenhouse with in amongst the plants. So a lot of plant monitoring so that if we do notice a new pest, just because you notice a pest doesn't mean it's an issue. It's once it hits sort of an economic threshold, and this goes across all of agriculture, that's when it becomes an issue. Whereas what we're looking at is actually releasing, knowing what pests like cannabis and like to visit our greenhouses. Even though our greenhouses are closed and we have strict hygiene measures, they still somehow sneak in there. And so what we have is a preventative program where we're releasing low numbers of these beneficials that are predatory to our known pests. And so we put out low numbers of those constantly. And if we did ever have a flare up, then we would perhaps bring in, an even more aggressive beneficial or increase those numbers. But you also just have, like physical exclusion. If you found that there was a little bit of an outbreak of something, you could actually just remove that one plant or the one leaf that you might find it on. So that's definitely an option. And then you just want to increase your monitoring and make sure that you're releasing your beneficials in that area. But also using things like sticky traps, which can help identify that you've got pests, but can also help to actually trap them as well.
Yeah, that's great information. What sorts of pests are most commonly, I guess, the cannabis plant? What does it attract? What sorts of pests are we dealing with primarily?
Look, cannabis attracts a lot of the usuals. Definitely aphids are an issue. You would hear some horror stories about spider mites. There's a variety of different aphids. We also get whitefly. Yeah, look, almost anything that would attack your home veggie garden is going to probably attack cannabis as well.
Now, you're running a perpetual harvest out there, so your greenhouse is darkening, auto-darkening, is that correct?
Yeah, so we've got light deprivation, so we've got blackout screens, so we can just automatically switch the flowering plants into flower as soon as we're ready.
Very cool. You mentioned that you have brought in your genetics from overseas. Can you just talk a little bit about, I guess you mentioned that it has to be from a federally legal source, so it can't be from the black market. So what sorts of countries are, I guess, people that are starting these facilities, where are they able to look to get these legal genetics into Australia?
Yeah, look, you can. There's quite a few countries in Europe. So, from the Netherlands and Spain and Italy, I believe, Canada I think you can actually get CBD dominant now from the US as well. So it's and there will be the potential from New Zealand as well, which is, well, I'm really grateful that New Zealand has an amnesty to bring in their illegal genetics. It does annoy me a bit that we don't have that in Australia. So obviously there is, you know, people have been growing cannabis in Australia forever. And so there are some amazing genetic lines here that have, you know, that are stabilized and used to the Australian climate. So it would be fantastic if we had an amnesty, which Canada had an amnesty. Like I said, New Zealand has an amnesty. It's unfortunate, but it's possible that if there was a fantastic genetic strain in Australia that you wanted to grow, you know, if you can get that to New Zealand somehow, they are able to get that into the legal system, and then I can purchase it and import it into Australia. And it just doesn't seem fair if I can bring genetics from Holland or from Canada that have had amnesties, but to bring in illegal genetics, but Australia doesn't have that amnesty. I think we're really missing out on some fantastic genetic lines, because even though it's been illegal in Australia, there has been a lot of people who have, you know, who have not, who have continued to grow and continue to supply medicine either to themselves or to those around them. And I think it's really unfortunate that we can't get access to some of those fantastic genetics that have been cultivated in Australia, you know, for decades.
There's one for all the advocates and lobbyists out there in Australia. Jump on that one, because that's a really good cause. If we could get that amnesty, as you say, there's some great genetics out there that are being missed out on, unfortunately. Can we talk about your grow methods out there? Are you guys doing, I believe you're doing run to waste cocoa, is that correct?
Yeah, yep. Yep, so we do run to waste, and we grow in coir, which is a coconut fiber. We've also got some trials at the moment into a new rock wool product that's been designed more specifically for cannabis. Both medias have their pros and cons. Coir obviously is, you know, potentially a bit more sustainable than looking at rock wool, but we use drip irrigation. All of our all of the nutrients are delivered to the plant through the irrigation water, and that's all automated. So we have different nutrient recipes depending on the life stage of the plant. But we actually water, you know, we irrigate regularly, small amounts, as opposed to sort of just watering once a day. We actually water multiple times over the day.
So high frequency fertigation out there, which is great to hear. We had an episode with a gentleman from the United States. He calls himself Dr. MJ Coco, and he's provided us a great episode on that high frequency fertigation. So it's cool to know that there are commercial cultivators out there using that methodology. Do you guys use, so you mentioned that you work to your own recipes. Do you use any ready-made bottle products that one might go to find at a hydroponic shop?
No, we don't use any products like that. One of the things that you really need to remember is that cannabis is a plant just like any other when it comes to growing. Yes, it is, you know, potentially a miracle of a plant, and it's got some fantastic qualities. But plants are still using, you know, your macro and micronutrients, your NPK, your nitrogen, phosphorus, potassium. You don't need something that's got canna in front of it with a cannabis tax on it. And I'm not saying that there aren't some fantastic, you know, premix products out there, but you're going to pay a lot more for them. If you have no idea what you're doing, of course, you know, go to one of these hydroponic shops, grab something where they've got, you know, that complete product. Obviously do your research first. I'm not entirely sure how many of these companies actually even label their products correctly with what's in them. And I can give you a great example. I was at an expo, maybe it was a HHI expo many, many years ago. And I was actually doing the rounds to look at all the fertilizers that these companies were selling. And often, you know, you always hear these, you know, the A and B. And so you'll grab your, you know, you need your cocoa A and your cocoa B, and then you need all these other supplements, and all of a sudden you're spending a fortune. And I was saying, you know, tell me about this. What's the difference between your A and your B? And then I looked on the back, and the formulas, like the NPK and all the other nutrients, were identical between the A and the B. And then the guy's trying to tell me, oh, but they're not the same. And I'm like, yeah, well, then your product's completely illegally labeled because they say they're identical. But to be honest, it's definitely one thing, you know, because I'm a grower coming from another industry, it is pretty frustrating when people put a cannabis tax on everything. And some of those premix, you know, you could just as easily, if you're not savvy enough to come up with your own mix, you know, the minerals and nutrients that we need to give the plants are the same as, you know, it's the same nutrients. It's just maybe slightly different combinations, or like, you know, how much nitrogen or how much potassium and how much calcium and magnesium do you need? It's all still the same, and the plant sees it the same, you know, whether it's a cannabis plant or a rose plant, it you don't need to pay for that cannabis tax.
What about mycorrhizae and trichoderma, things like this? Do you utilize that in your program?
Yeah. Look, we use a lot of biological control agents like beneficial bacteria and fungi, and that can be sort of to boost the root system of the plant, or to improve sort of the immune system, so to speak, of the plant, and that soil biome. But some of those are also really useful in getting rid of some of the pests that you might find in your cannabis crop as well.
Beautiful. Now you're looking to build a new facility in Shepparton, Victoria. It sounds like this is going to be something fairly substantial. Can you tell us a little bit about what your proposal is and what you're hoping to achieve out there?
Yeah, so our plan for our second facility is in Shepparton. It's really disappointing that we were not able to begin construction this year due to COVID, obviously, no surprises there. So we are hoping to now start construction in first quarter 2021. So we have plans, and we've got building and ODC approvals to build a 16-hectare facility. So that's about 50 times the size of our facility that we currently have in Brisbane. But we are not, we won't be building that full 16 hectares all in one hit. So the plan is that will be a staged project, and it'll grow to suit the market. So if it's definitely something that we've learnt, you know, from our neighbours up in North America, it's not to go too big too fast, and to make sure that you've got a market for your product. It is, you know, really great growing conditions down in regional Victoria. So summer, like we've got great climatic conditions here in Queensland. Some of our, you know, some of the areas that we can struggle with a bit up here, of course, is the heat and the humidity, which can all be controlled for, of course, under protected cropping, so in greenhouse production. But when we're looking down in Shepparton, you know, there's really great daylight hours. Humidity is definitely not one of our bigger concerns down there. Heating is a lot more important. But where we have designed a real state-of-the-art glasshouse facility down there, where the plan is to be vertically integrated, so that we'll also have our extraction and packaging facility on the same site there as well. So we're looking at staged construction down there to meet the market needs, but also to look, you know, it's really important for Australians to be competitive. We actually need to look at economies of scale to bring that price down, which is something that's really important for Australian patients. And it's critical that we, you know, that we look at high levels of automation to remove the labor cost. So we know in Australia, labor's one of our key high expenses. So is electricity. So, you know, some other parts of the world that are growing medical cannabis, you know, have cheaper electricity costs and or cheaper labor costs. And that's where we've got to be smart and invest in, you know, certain economies of scale and certain level of automation, so that we can reduce our electricity costs and our labor costs, and then you know, that just drives the price of production down. And then the, you know, we can deliver medicine to the patient at a much cheaper price as well.
You mentioned North America, our friends in North America, and the importance of not going too big too soon. I guess we're loosely referring to Canada and what took place there with legalization. Now, what problems emerged from them having a massive excess of biomass?
Well, I mean, one, they've just got all this biomass sitting in vaults, not going anywhere, which obviously doesn't help anyone, doesn't help the shareholders of those companies. It doesn't help the companies themselves, of course. Potentially it can help the patient if it means the price comes down, but it's definitely not a situation that we want to be in Australia. And look, in Canada, it really was a green rush, and it was how quickly can people expand their facilities, and they were getting incredible returns per gram that we're never going to see here in Australia. So any Australian businesses out there that their business models are based off inflated price per gram, you know, you're shooting yourself in the foot before you even start, because the price per gram is only going to come down. So you need to be looking at, you know, your business plan needs to be looking at more of a realistic return, because as more and more people come in the game, you know, their cost of production, they become more efficient. So their cost of production comes down. So definitely while everyone was racing to expand in Canada, and you know, buying old flower farms and retrofitting them as quickly as possible. So definitely not efficient production when it comes to, you know, greenhouse production if you're producing cucumbers or tomatoes that obviously have a much smaller return per gram or per kilo than cannabis. But so people were able to overextend themselves on these inflated returns. And then all of a sudden, you know, the prices dropped trying to match the illicit market, but also trying to match their competitors. And all of a sudden there were other companies that could produce for less and produce, you know, for lower and lower, and then more companies come on the market at the same time. And then all of a sudden they've overextended, they're not getting those returns. The bubble definitely burst in Canada when it, you know, just like the real estate bubble burst here in Australia, you know, some time ago. Like, anything that is growing exponentially like that, it has to crash at some point and then restabilize. And that's what we've seen in Canada. And it's those companies that had overextended themselves and overpromised their shareholders that are the ones that have been hit the hardest. And unfortunately, that's had negative implications on the Australian industry, because it's removed some of that confidence from investing in the Australian medical cannabis industry. And quite rightly so. I mean, if you're watching what's happening overseas, you know, you'd be doing your homework to be looking at what was happening overseas before you were investing in Australia. But it's definitely done us no favors in for the broader Australian industry by, you know, just making people a little bit more hesitant before they invest.
I think we should touch on some of the effects of coronavirus on the Australian cannabis market and, some of the repercussions.
Yeah, look, COVID definitely, as I mentioned before, has set us back for expanding out for our second facility. It definitely posed a lot of challenges for us to continue cultivating through COVID. So we obviously had a COVID and do have a COVID-safe plan. We originally split our team into two teams, a bit like a medical team, you know, just in case one person contracted COVID or had to be tested. We definitely couldn't have our entire site, everybody quarantining at home waiting for their results, or the plants would die. So it was definitely a challenge as we split into two teams, so that which was important to make sure that the business could go on operating. We've been very lucky. We're based in Queensland. For people tuning in from around the country, I know that Queensland's definitely hasn't done it as tough as some of the other states. We're very lucky in that sense. But that definitely posed challenges operating through COVID. We've increased our staff this year. hugely, which was really difficult trying to employ staff. One, because we couldn't employ anyone from interstate or overseas. And obviously there's not that many cannabis experts in Australia, like with commercial cannabis experience. So that was quite difficult. But also with the JobKeeper payments, you know, trying to find people just to come and harvest or do pretty menial tasks. You know, if you were getting paid that much at home, you know, why would you want to come out and work 40 plus hours a week and only earn a certain amount extra? So staffing was definitely a bit of a challenge, but we've onboarded a fantastic team despite that this year. And it's definitely meant that the Australian industry is now, you know, not really able to rely on bringing in experts from overseas, which I do know of a couple of companies in Australia that have, you know, that have brought in, you know, potential lead growers and people like that to join their team. And that now is, you know, obviously very difficult to try and get a foreign worker to come into Australia now. But luckily we can now, you know, staff can at least move around the country a little bit easier. But, you know, I had job applications from people all around the country and it was like, well, you know, if you're in Melbourne or if you're in Sydney, it was just not even possible to get them to come in for an interview, let alone actually move interstate and start work.
So when we talk about staffing and numbers and stuff, when you open this facility in Shepparton, what sorts of employment numbers are we expecting to see down there?
Ooh, a lot. When we've built the full 16 hectares, it's probably between 400 and 600 plus employees. So even just designing that facility and the security, I mean, lunchrooms, change rooms, where do people park? How do they get in? You know, like obviously it's a highly secure facility. You know, people got to get changed into their scrubs. It definitely was a bit of a challenge designing that facility. But we do have good relationships with the local TAFE in Shepparton. And so we've been working with them so that we'll be able to actually train our staff either at the TAFE or actually on site at our facility. Because one of the issues with with this new industry in Australia is that there's no staff that in Australia that are experienced in growing medical cannabis on a commercial scale. So you've either got people who can grow in a greenhouse commercially, but it's cucumbers, tomatoes, etc. Or they'll tell you they've got cannabis experience, and maybe it's, and obviously that's going to be a legal experience. But there's a huge difference between growing 10 or even 100 plants in your backyard or in your basement or in a wardrobe or something like that. And then going to, do you actually understand the fundamentals of growing in a greenhouse? So for me, and for anyone out there who's looking at starting a cannabis cultivation facility, you really want to be looking for staff who have commercial greenhouse experience and then get them to learn cannabis after that. Whereas trying to find someone who's got, you know, the home grow cannabis experience and then trying to educate them on what it's like to grow in a commercial greenhouse is a lot more difficult. Or if you're really lucky, pair those two people together. Yeah. Because then you'll have your cannabis expertise and then you'll have your commercial greenhouse expertise. And that would be a fantastic, you know, two fantastic people to build your cultivation team with.
Yeah. I love what you mentioned with the interaction with TAFE down in Victoria. I understand there's at least one Western Australian company that's about to start up. They've got funding. I think they're just about to approve receive their approval for their licensing, who's looking at a very similar model of integrating with the tertiary institutions and TAFEs and some of the universities here to have something going on site for on site training. And it's a great concept. I really like that because, as we mentioned, you know, 400 to 600 people to come onto an operation in an industry that didn't exist 4 years ago is going to be quite the challenge.
Yeah, and I think it's really important to work, you know, to work with those partners, training facilities, because it's not just in medical cannabis; it's actually in horticulture in general. It's actually really hard to find qualified like green, you know, staff that know how to run a high-tech greenhouse. Like that's already difficult in Australia to find those expertise. So to combine that with cannabis, you know, the pool of potential staff is even more reduced. So we, you know, at Cannatrek, we're heavily invested in our staff. So we train all of our staff on site. But obviously once we're looking at Shepparton, we're going to need help with that because it's too many staff for us to do all the training ourselves. And we've actually worked with one of Australia's leading bodies for developing coursework to actually bring in a medical cannabis cultivation course into the TAFE network in Australia. So I'm assuming that's going to start to be rolled out next year. So if anyone listening is interested in actually learning, you know, commercial greenhouse growing but specializing in cannabis, then keep your eye out for that because that program is meant to be being released next year. But otherwise, anything you can educate yourself on when it comes to greenhouse growing or protected cropping of any sorts will definitely be beneficial if you're trying to get into cannabis cultivation.
Yeah, it's great to hear that that's about to roll out actually, and great to hear that there are legitimate avenues for people to get that training about to arise. Well done on that one. You guys are entirely private. Is that correct? You're not a publicly listed company.
We're not listed on the ASX, yep. But you can buy shares in Cannatrek. Yeah.
Okay. And
so we will be, I imagine we will be listed on the ASX sometime in the future. However, I'm probably not the best person to ask exactly when that will be.
No, that's cool. Okay. So,
but we do, yeah.
Can people access, how do people invest if there are people out there that do want to invest at this stage? What's the process there?
Yeah, so you might have seen that we've had a recent crowd equity funding release. And so what this enables is because we're not listed on the ASX, you can only sort of privately invest in Cannatrek. But through this crowdfunding opportunity, it means you can join the Cannatrek journey and invest in Cannatrek, so purchase shares, but for at a much lower price. I couldn't tell you exactly how much it is, we could definitely share the link to the crowdfunding if any of your listeners are interested in investing and jumping on board the Cannatrek journey.
For people interested in that, you guys are a true seed to patient model, I understand. So you're involved in every step of the chain, is that correct?
Yeah, I guess being involved from startup, but also sort of being head of research and development, definitely, you know, you have those touch points along the whole supply chain. So, you know, and everything from, you know, picking what seeds are being imported all the way through, you know, to product formulations, patient access, doctor education, research, a little bit of everything, having that sort of holistic helicopter view of the company and the industry.
Very cool. And can we hope to see some other cannabinoids being produced by you guys down the track? I know there's some breeders out there now bringing some, you know, CBG strains, THCV varieties of those types. Do you have your eye on those?
Yeah, look, as I mentioned before, we brought in 20 different genetic varieties and we have been looking at the minor cannabinoids and terpene profiles. One thing we haven't really talked about is sativa versus indica strains, which is something I definitely try and steer away from just because any of the legal genetics that we have access to, you know, are so hybridized that it's not really possible to determine if they are in fact indica or sativa. And if you actually have a look at them, you know, actually look at the genetics closely, they're all hybridized. So you can have a look at some of the research, you know, proper academic research that's actually looked into, you know, these potential subspecies. And I do hope that, you know, we do have pure land races preserved somewhere, you know, in the world. But I think with how popular this plant has been for tens of thousands of years, we've been trading this seed, you know, for thousands and thousands of years. And so we've crossed and hybridized so many things that we really don't You know, anything that's being sold as an indica or a sativa on the Australian market, also, you know, in other markets, really are not necessarily what you're thinking as an indica or a sativa from a scientific standpoint. And so what I encourage, you know, patients and doctors and researchers to really start looking into is these minor cannabinoids. So THC and CBD are just two of over 100 different cannabinoids, not to mention, you know, the flavonoids and over 100 different terpenes. So you really need to start to look at these terpene and cannabinoid profiles, some of these minor cannabinoids. And we're, I think we're not quite ready in the Australian industry for that just yet. Like, I don't think doctors and patients, you know, we've just educated them on THC and CBD. So, you know, we've got to take it one step at a time. But definitely, you know, patients are going to start to realize, you know, that this particular, you know, this particular has worked better for them for sleep, whereas this one's worked better, you know, for them to keep functioning and keep working throughout the day. And it's not whether it's so-called indica or sativa that is doing that. It is, you know, it's that entourage effect, not just from the THC and CBD, but from those minor cannabinoids and terpene profiles that are really only there in trace amounts. You know, as a research scientist myself, I'm so excited to start to see such a, you know, a more diverse product range coming out with more choices when it comes to terpene and cannabinoid profiles. But, you know, and then for patients to actually find that, you know, that effect, and then the clinical trials catching up to show what works best, you know, for different indications. But it's a real personalized medicine.
I love that you mention, I guess, the irrelevance of the indica sativa thing in the modern world. We did have an episode with Robert Connell Clark where he ran through the whole debate with indica sativa, and he basically puts cannabis now into different time eras, where he has proposed a pre-Afghan, an Afghan, and a post-Afghan period. And his concept being that post-Afghan period, there's no such thing as a true land race anymore, that everything is entirely hybridized. Mm-hmm. And I found it quite fascinating that people such as yourself, such as Robert, are willing to, I guess, try and push that education even further and take away some of those old school thoughts.
Yeah, so it's definitely agreed in the scientific community, you know, as plant scientists, that there is only a single species, but there is, you know, discussion around whether there are subspecies, but whether we can actually identify those subspecies anymore. You know, if you're actually looking at it scientifically, it's really, really difficult. But as I said before, you know, I do really hope that we've got some landrace strains that have been preserved in some corners of the world. But, you know, if any of your listeners watch strain hunters and people like that, you know, people have been doing this for hundreds, thousands of years. So, you know, even if they're going to go trekking into the wilderness, people have already been there and people have already brought seeds, because it's, you know, it's something that's really brought people together, and people have traded it. You know, some of the oldest, you know, when we find human remains and things like that in a caveman in a cave somewhere, and they often have cannabis seeds in a pouch around their neck. Like, it's something that we have traded and carried and prized as part of humanity for as far back as history dates.
Yeah, that's
and that's why it's unfortunate it's taken this long for it to come back to us. But we really need to embrace it and work as quickly as we can to make up for lost time.
That's a fair call. I think if anybody did have a landrace in their possession, it would probably be Arjan Roskamp in his nice freezer there in Amsterdam. But I see what you're saying, that, yeah, even those places have well and truly been farmed, and people have definitely trekked through there prior. So it'd be very hard to find something untouched. Emily, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. Really cool to talk to you, really cool to learn from you. Thank you very much for coming on board and educating our listeners, having a chat, telling us a bit about yourself. It's been really cool. Thank you.
Yeah, no, thanks so much, guys. Really, really had fun chatting with you, and always happy to answer anyone's questions. And, you know, we need to educate more and more. So, yeah, the more we can talk about this, the better.
That's very cool. Thank you very much, Emily. Thanks for your time, and take care.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to another episode of Cantor.
Any guest views and opinions expressed in this podcast are those of the guests and not necessarily those of the hosts. Canta strongly suggests listeners research local, state, and federal laws and regulations before conducting any cannabis-related activity.